of Yad El. Along the hilltops at the far end of the Hula was Tel Hai, where Trumpeldor fell, and across the valley was Mount Hermon and Syria. Karen was dressed in olive drab slacks and high-collared peasant's blouse, and she wore new sandals on her feet.
"Oh, Dov, this is the most wonderful day of my life," she cried. "Yona is lots of fun, and she was telling me that Dr. Lieberman is the nicest man on earth."
She rolled in the grass and looked up in the sky and sighed. Dov stood over her, wordless. She sat up and took his hand and tugged at him to sit beside her.
"Cut it out," he said.
She persisted, and he sat down. He became nervous as she squeezed his hand and lay her head on his shoulder.
"Please be happy, Dov. Please be happy."
He shrugged and pulled away from her.
"Please be happy.
Who cares about it?"
"I care," Karen said. "I care for you."
"Well, care for yourself."
"I care for myself, too."
She knelt in front of him and gripped his shoulders.
"Did you see your room and your bed? How long has it been since you've been in a room like that?"
Dov flushed at the touch of her hands and lowered his eyes.
"Just think, Dov. No more displaced persons camps. No more La Ciotas. No more Carolos. No more illegal ships. We are home, Dov. And it is even more beautiful than I dreamed."
Dov got to his feet slowly and turned his back.
"This place is fine for you. I got other plans."
"Please forget them," she pleaded.
The orchestra played and the music drifted over the green.
"We had better get to the theater," Karen said.
Once Ari and Kitty left Tel Aviv and drove past the huge British camp at Sarafand, she felt the tension of Palestine again. They passed through the all-Arab city of Ramleh on the road to Jerusalem and felt angry Arab eyes on them. Ari seemed oblivious of the Arabs and oblivious of Kitty. He had not spoken a dozen words to her all day. Beyond Ramleh, the car turned into the Bab el-Wad, a snaking road that twisted up into the Judean hills. Young forests planted by the Jews pushed up from the earth on ravines on either side of the road. Deep into the hills stood ancient terracing that stood out from the denuded earth like ribs of a starving dog. Once these very hills and terraces supported hundreds of thousands of people. Now it was completely eroded. The hilltops held Arab villages clustered in white clumps above them. Here in the Bab el-Wad, the magic pull of Jerusalem gripped Kitty Fremont. It was said that none could pass through the Judean hills for the first time and escape the haunting power of the city of David. It seemed strange to Kitty that she should feel it so intensely. Her religious training had been in matter-of-fact Midwestern Protestantism. It had been approached with a basic sincerity and a lack of intensity. Higher and higher they drove, and the anticipation became greater. She was with the Bible now. And for the first time, in these silent and weird hills, came the realization of what it was to be in the Holy Land. In the distance, a dim outline of the citadels of Jerusalem jutted on the horizon, and Kitty Fremont was filled with a kind of exaltation. They entered the new city, built by the Jews, and drove down Jaffa Road, the principal commercial spine that passed crowded shops, toward the wall of the old city. At the Jaffa Gate, Ari turned and drove along the wall to King David Avenue, and in a few moments stopped before the great King David Hotel. Kitty stepped from the car and gasped at the sight of the right wing of the hotel sheared away.
"It was once British headquarters," Ari said. "The Maccabees changed all that."
The hotel was built of Jerusalem stone. It was grandiose in the overburdened European manner, with its lobby an alleged duplication of King David's court. Kitty came down to lunch first. She waited on the terrace in the rear of the hotel that looked over a small valley to the old city wall. The terrace was opposite David's tower and was set in a formal garden. A four-piece orchestra behind her played luncheon music. Ari walked out to the terrace and stopped in his tracks. Kitty looked lovely. He had never seen her like this before. She wore a flouncy and chic cocktail dress and a wide-brimmed hat and white gloves. At that moment, he felt far away from her. She was all the lovely women in Rome and in Paris and even Berlin who belonged to a world in which women acted in a way he could not quite understand. It was a light year from Kitty to Daphne, but she was beautiful indeed. He seated himself.
I have spoken to Harriet Saltzman. We will see her right after lunch.
Thanks. I'm very excited about Jerusalem.
She has mysterious powers. Everyone is excited on his first visit. Take David Ben-Ami. David never gets over Jerusalem. Matter of fact, he will be sightseeing with you tomorrow. It is the Sabbath. He wants to take you into the old city.
He is sweet to think of me.
Ari looked at her closely. She seemed even prettier now than when he entered the terrace. He turned his eyes away and signaled for a waiter, then stared off into space after giving the order. Kitty had the feeling now that Ari had committed himself and was anxious to complete his obligation. No word passed between them for 10 minutes. She picked at her salad.
Do I bore you?
Of course not.
Since you came back from your engagement last night, you've acted as though I haven't existed.
I'm sorry, Kitty, he said without looking at her. I guess I have been rather bad company today.
Is there something wrong?
There's a lot wrong, but it doesn't concern you or me or my bad manners. Let me tell you about Harriet Saltzman. She's an American. She must be well over 80 years old now. If we conferred sainthoods in the Yeshuv, she would be our first saint. See that hill beyond the old city?
Over there?
That's Mount Scopus. Those buildings make up the most modern medical center in the Middle East. The money comes from American Zionist women that Harriet organized after the First World War. Most of the hospital and medical centers in Palestine come from her Hadassah organization.
She sounds like quite a girl.
Yes, she is. When Hitler came to power, Harriet organized Youth Aliyah. She is responsible for saving thousands of youngsters. They maintain dozens of youth centers all over Palestine. You'll get along fine with her.
Why do you say that?
Well, no Jew who has lived in Palestine can ever go without leaving his heart here. It's the same way with Americans, I think. Harriet has been here for years, but she's still very much an American. The orchestra stopped playing. A silence fell over Jerusalem. They could hear the faint cry of a Muslim muezzin calling his people to prayer from a minaret in the old city. Then it became quiet again, with a stillness that Kitty had never experienced. The bells from the carillon in the YMCA tower over the street played a hymn, and the tones flooded the hills and the valleys. And then, again it became still. It was so peaceful, it would have been sacrilegious to speak. All life and all time seemed to stand still in one moment.
What an utterly wonderful sensation, Kitty said.
Those kinds of moments are rarities these days, Ari said. I am afraid that the calm is deceptive.
Ari saw a small, olive-skinned man standing at the terrace door. He recognized the man as Bar Yisrael, the contact for the Maccabees. Bar Yisrael nodded to Ari and disappeared.
Will you excuse me for a moment? Ari said.
He walked into the lobby to the cigarette stand and purchased a pack and then thumbed through a magazine. Bar Yisrael walked up alongside him.
Your Uncle Akiva is in Jerusalem,
Bar Yisrael whispered.
He wants to see you.
I have to go to the Zion Settlement Society, but I will be free shortly after.
Meet me in the Russian compound,
the contact man said, and hastened through the lobby. King George Avenue was a wide boulevard in the new city, and was lined with administrative buildings and schools and churches. The Zion Settlement Society, a large, four-storied rambling affair, stood on a corner. A long driveway led to the main entrance.
"Shalom, Ari,"
Harriet Saltzman said, prancing from behind her desk with an agility that belied her years. She stood on her toes, put her arms around Ari's neck, and kissed his cheek heartily.
"Oh, what a job you did on them at Cyprus. You are a good boy."
Kitty watched quietly in the doorway. The old woman turned to her.
"So this is Catherine Fremont. My child, you are very lovely."
"Thank you, Mrs. Saltzman."
"Don't make with the Mrs. Saltzman. Only Englishmen and Arabs call me that. It makes me feel old. Sit down, sit down. I'll order tea. Or perhaps you would rather have coffee."
"Tea is fine."
"So you see, Ari, this is what an American girl looks like."
Harriet made a gesture of tribute to Kitty's beauty, with mischief twinkling in her eyes. "I'm certain that not all American girls are as pretty as Kitty."
"Stop it, both of you. You're embarrassing me."
"You girls don't need me. I have a few things to do, so I'll just beat it. Kitty, if I'm not back for you, would you mind taking a taxi back to the hotel?"
"Go already," the old woman said. "Kitty and I are going to have dinner together at my flat. Who needs you?"
Ari smiled and left.
"That's a fine boy," Harriet Saltzman said. "We have lots of good boys like Ari. They work too hard. They die too young."
She lit a cigarette and offered Kitty one.
"And where do you hail from?"
"Indiana."
"San Francisco here."
"It is a lovely city," Kitty said. "I visited it once with my husband. I always hope to go back someday."
"I do too," the old woman said. "It seems that I miss the States more every year. For 15 years I have sworn I would go back for a while, but the work never seems to stop here. All these poor babies coming in. But I get homesick. Senility is creeping up on me, I guess."
"Hardly."
"It is good to be a Jew working for the rebirth of a Jewish nation, but it is also a very good thing to be an American, and don't you ever forget that, young lady. Ever since the Exodus incident started, I've been very anxious to meet you, Catherine Fremont, and I must say I am tremendously surprised, and I don't surprise easily."
"I am afraid that the reports over-romanticized me."
Behind Harriet Saltzman's disarming friendliness functioned a shrewd brain, and even though Kitty was completely at ease, she realized how carefully the old woman was estimating her. They sipped their tea and chatted, mostly about America. Harriet became nostalgic.
"I go home next year. I will find an excuse. Maybe a fundraising drive. We're always having fundraising drives. Do you know that the American Jews give us more than all Americans give to the Red Cross? So why should I bore you with these things? So, you want to go to work for us?"
"I'm sorry that I don't have my credentials with me."
"You don't need them. We know all about you."
"Oh?"
"Yes. We have a half dozen reports already on file."
"I don't know whether to be pleased or offended."
"Don't be offended. It is the times. We must be sure of everyone. You will find that we are really a small community here, and very little happens that doesn't come back to these ancient ears. As a matter of fact, I was reading our files on you before you came this afternoon, and I was wondering why you have come to us."
"I am a nurse, and you need nurses."
Harriet Saltzman shook her head.
"Outsiders don't come to us for that reason. There must be another one. Did you come to Palestine for Ari Ben Canaan?"
"No. Of course, I am fond of him."
100 women are fond of him. You happen to be the woman he is fond of."
"I don't think so, Harriet."
"Well, I am glad, Catherine. It is a long way from Yad El to Indiana. He is a Sabra, and only another Sabra could really understand him."
"Sabra?" It is a term we use for the native-born. A sabra is the fruit of a wild cactus you will find all over Palestine. The sabra is hard on the outside, but inside it is very tender and sweet. That is a good description. Ari and the other sabras have no conception of American life, just as you have no conception of what his life has been. Let me be very candid. When a Gentile comes to us, he comes as a friend. You are not a friend. You are not one of us. You are a very beautiful American girl who is completely puzzled by these strange people called Jews. Now, why are you here? It's not that mysterious. I am very fond of a young girl. She came over on the Exodus. We met earlier in Garolos. I'm afraid her attempts to reunite with her father may end very unhappily. If she is unable to find her father, I want to adopt her and take her to America. I see. Well, you are on the level. Let us talk Turkey. There is an opening for a head nurse in one of our youth villages in the northern Galilee. It is a lovely place. The director is one of my oldest and dearest friends, Dr. Ernest Lieberman. The village is called Gan Dafna. We have 400 children there, and most of them are concentration camp bred. They need help badly. I do hope you will take this assignment. The pay and the facilities are very good. I would like to know about Karen Hansen. How did you know? I told you we were a small community. Karen is at Gan Dafna. I don't know how to thank you. Thank Ari. He is the one who arranged it all. Ari will take you up there. It is very close to his home.
The old woman emptied her teacup and leaned back in her chair.
Could I give you one last piece of advice? Of course. I have been working with orphans since 1933. The attachment they form for Palestine may be something very difficult for you to understand. Once they have breathed the air of freedom, once they are filled with this patriotism, it is extremely difficult for them to leave. And if and when they do, most of them never become adjusted to living away from Palestine. Their devotion is a fierce thing. Americans take so many things about America for granted. Here, a person wakes up every morning in doubt and tension, not knowing if all he is slaved for will be taken from him. Their country is with them 24 hours a day. It is the focal point of their lives, the very meaning of their existence. Are you trying to say I may not be able to persuade the girl to leave? I am trying to make you aware that you are fighting tremendous odds.
There was a knock on the door.
Come in.
David Ben-Ami entered.
Shalom, Harriet. Shalom, Kitty. Ari told me that I could find you here. Am I interrupting anything?
No, we've finished our business. I am sending Catherine to Gan Dafna.
Splendid! I thought that it would be a good idea to show Kitty around Mea Sharim when the Sabbath starts.
An excellent idea, David.
Then we had better get started. Will you come with us, Harriet?
Lug these old bones around? Not on your life. You have Catherine at my flat for dinner in 2 hours.
Kitty stood up and shook hands with the old woman and thanked her, and then turned to David. He stared at her.
Is something wrong, David? Kitty asked. I have never seen you dressed up. You look very beautiful.
He looked at himself awkwardly.
Perhaps I am not dressed well enough to walk around with you.
Nonsense.
I was just trying to show off for my new boss.
Shalom, children. I will see you later.
Kitty was pleased that David had come for her. She felt more comfortable around him than with any of the other Jews. They walked from the Zion Settlement Society and crossed to the Street of the Prophets. Kitty took his arm, but it seemed as though David was the one who was the sightseer. He was rediscovering everything about Jerusalem, and he was as delighted as a child.
"It is so good to be home again," he said. "How do you like my city? Are there words?"
"It is overwhelming and a little frightening."
"Yes, that is the way I have always felt about Jerusalem ever since I was a boy. It never fails to thrill me and to haunt me."
"It was very kind of you to take time away from your family."
"We are not all assembled yet. I have 6 brothers, you know. Most of them are in the Palmach. I am the baby of the family, so there will be a reunion. All of us except one. I will have to see him alone later."
"Is he ill?"
"He is a terrorist. He is with the Maccabees.
My father will not permit him to enter our house. He is with Ben Moshe, a leader of the Maccabees. Ben Moshe was once my professor at the Hebrew University."
David stopped and pointed to Mount Scopus beyond the Hadassah Medical Center and beyond the Valley of Kidron.
"There is the university.
You miss it very much, don't you?"
"Yes, of course. Someday I will have the chance to go back."
The froggy sound of a horn blasted as it turned dusk.
"Sabbath! Sabbath!"
A call went up along the streets. All over Jerusalem, the sound of the ancient horn could be heard. David put on a small skullcap and led Kitty to the street of Mea Shearim, the 100 gates of the ultra-Orthodox.
"Here, in Mea Shearim, you will be able to look into the synagogues and see the men pray in many different ways. Some of the Yemenites pray with a swaying motion, as though they were riding on a camel. This was their way of getting even, as Jews were not allowed to ride camels because it would make their heads higher than a Muslim's. I am impressed. Take the descendants of Spanish Jews. During the Inquisition, they were forced to convert to Catholicism on pain of death. They said their Latin prayers aloud, but at the end of each sentence they whispered a Hebrew prayer under their breaths. They still pray in silence at the end of each sentence."
Kitty was speechless when they turned into Mea Shearim. The street comprised connected 2-story stone dwellings, all displaying iron grillwork on their balconies. The men were bearded and wore side curls, and fur-brimmed hats, and long black satin coats. There were Yemenites in Arabic dress, and Kurds, and Bukharans, and Persians in riotous colored silks. Everyone walked from the ritual bath with a quick-paced bobbing motion, as though swaying in prayer. In a few moments, the street emptied into the synagogues, small rooms for the most part, and several on each block. There were congregations from Italy and Afghanistan and Poland and Hungary and Morocco. The Mea Shearim was filled with the chanting of prayers and Sabbath songs and weeping voices of anguished Hasidim who whipped themselves into a furor. Women were not permitted to enter rooms of prayer, so David and Kitty had to content themselves with peeking through iron-grilled windows.
What strange rooms! What strange people!
Kitty watched near-hysterical men cluster about the Sefer Torah, wailing and moaning. She saw the angelic faces of Yemenites who sat cross-legged on pillows, softly praying. She saw old men weaving back and forth, emitting a stream of Hebrew in monotone, read from decrepit prayer books. How different and how far away they all were from the handsome men and women of Tel Aviv.
"We have all kinds of Jews," David Ben-Ami said. "I wanted to bring you here because I know that Ari wouldn't. He and many of the Sabras despise them. They do not farm the land. They do not bear arms. They shove an ancient brand of Judaism down our throats. They are a force of reaction against what we are trying to do. Yet, when one lives in Jerusalem, as I have, we learn to tolerate them and even appreciate the horrible things in the past that could drive men to such fanaticism."
Ari Ben Kanan waited near the Greek church in the Russian compound. It turned dark. Bar Yisrael appeared from nowhere. Ari followed the contact man into an alley where a taxi waited. They got in, and Bar Yisrael produced a large black handkerchief.
"Must I submit to this?"
"I trust you, Ari, but orders are orders."
The blindfold was tied over Ari's eyes, and Ari was made to lie on the floor and was covered by a blanket. For a long 20 minutes, the taxi moved in zigzags and circuitous routes to confuse Ari, then headed toward the Katamon district near the former German colony. The taxi stopped. Ari was quickly led into a house and into a room, and was told he could remove the kerchief. The room was bare except for a single chair, a single table which held a single flickering candle, and a bottle of brandy and 2 glasses. It took a full moment for Ari's eyes to adjust to the darkness. His uncle, Akiva, stood opposite him by the table. Akiva's beard and his hair had turned snow white. He was wrinkled and bent. Ari walked to him very slowly and stopped before him.
"Hello, uncle," he said.
"Ari, my boy."
The 2 men embraced, and the older man had to fight back choking emotion. Akiva lifted the candle and held it close to Ari's face, and he smiled.
"You are looking well, Ari. It was a good job you did in Cyprus."
"Thank you."
"You came with a girl, I hear."
"An American woman who helped us. She is not a friend, really." "How are you feeling, uncle?"
Akiva shrugged.
"As well as I can be expected to feel living in the underground. It has been too long since I have seen you, Ari. Too long. Over 2 years now. It was nice when Jordana was studying at the university. I saw her once each week. She must be nearly 20 now. How is she? Does she still care for that boy?"
"David Ben-Ami?
Yes.
They are very much in love. David was with me at Cyprus. He is one of our most promising young people."
"His brother is a Maccabee, you know. Ben Moshe used to teach him at the university. Perhaps I can meet him someday."
"Of course."
"I hear Jordana is in the Palmach."
"Yes, she is in charge of training the children at Gan Dafna, and she works on the mobile radio when it transmits from our area."
"She must be around my kibbutz, then. She must see a lot of Ein Or."
"Yes."
Does she ever say how it looks?"
"It is always beautiful at Ein Or."
"Perhaps I can see it one day again."
Akiva sat down at the table and poured 2 brandies with an unsteady hand. Ari took a glass, and they touched them.
"L'chaim," he said.
"I was with Avedan yesterday, uncle. He showed me the British battle order. Have your people seen it?"
"We have friends in British intelligence."
Akiva stood up and began to pace the room slowly.
"Havenhurst means to wipe out my organization. The British are dedicated to the destruction of the Maccabees. They torture our prisoners, they hang us, they have exiled our entire command. It is not bad enough that the Maccabees are the only ones with the courage to fight the British. We must also fight the betrayers among our own people." "Oh yes, Ari. We know the Haganah has been turning us in."
"That is not true," Ari gasped.
"It is true."
"No. Just today, at Yishuv Central, Havenhurst demanded that the Jews destroy the Maccabees, and they again refused."
Akiva's pacing quickened, and his anger rose.
"Where do you think the British get their information, if not from the Haganah? Those cowards at Yishuv Central let the Maccabees do the bleeding and the dying. Those cowards betray and betray. Cleverly, yes, but they betray, betray, betray."
"I won't listen to this, uncle. Most of us in the Haganah and the Palmach are dying to fight. They restrain us until we burst, but we cannot destroy everything that has been built."
"Say it. We destroy."
Ari gritted his teeth and held his tongue. The old man ranted. Then suddenly he stopped and flopped his arms to his sides.
"I am a master at creating arguments when I don't mean to."
"It is all right, uncle."
"I am sorry, Ari. Here, have some more brandy, please."
"No, thank you."
Akiva turned his back and murmured,
"How is my brother?"
"He was well when I saw him last.
He will be going to London to join the conferences.
Yes, dear Barak, he will talk. He will talk to the end.
Akiva wetted his lips and hesitated.
Does he know that you and Yordana and Sarah see me?
I think so. Akiva faced his nephew. His face reflected the sorrow within him.
Does he ever ask about me?
No. Akiva gave a hurt little laugh and sank into the chair and poured more brandy for himself.
How strange things are. I was always the one who angered, and Barak was always the one who forgave. Ari, I am getting very tired. A year, another year. I don't know how long it will be. Nothing can ever undo the hurt that we have brought to each other. But he must find it in his heart to break this silence. Ari, he must forgive me for the sake of our father.
Chapter 3 100 church bells from the old city and the valley of Kidron and the Mount of Olives and Mount Zion pealed in chorus to the YMCA carillon. It was Sunday in Jerusalem, the Christian Sabbath. David Ben-Ami took Kitty into the old city through the ornate Damascus Gate, and they walked along the Via Dolorosa, the Way of the Cross, to Stephen's Gate, which looked over the Kidron Valley, and the tombs of Zacharias and Absalom and Mary, and to the Mount of Olives, the scene of the Ascension. They walked through the narrow streets, through the Arab bazaar and the tiny shops and the scenes of wild bartering. At the Dome of the Rock, the Mosque of Omar, 1,000 pairs of shoes covered the steps. Ancient bearded Jews stood and wept before the wailing wall of their great temple. How strange this place is, again Kitty Fremont mused. Here, so far away in these barren hills, the merging point of 100 civilizations in its thousands of years. Of all the earth, why this place, this street, this wall? This church. Romans and Crusaders and Greeks and Turks and Arabs and Assyrians and Babylonians and British in the city of the maligned Hebrews. It is holy, it is sacred, it is damned. Everything strong and everything weak, all that is good in man and all that is evil in him are personified. Calvary and Gethsemane. The room of the Last Supper. The Last Supper of Jesus. A Jewish Passover Seder. David took Kitty to the Holy Sepulchre, the site of the crucifixion, and the tiny chapel lit with ornate hanging lamps and perpetually burning candles over the marble tomb of Jesus Christ. Kitty knelt beside the tomb and kissed it, as it had been kissed thin by a million pilgrims. The next morning, Ari and Kitty left Jerusalem and continued northward into the Galilee. They drove through the timeless Arab villages into the fertile carpet of the Israel Valley, which the Jews had turned from swamp into the finest farmland in the Middle East. As the road wound out of the Israel toward Nazareth again, they moved backwards in time. On one side of the hill, the lush lands of the Israel, and on the other, the sun-baked, dried-out, barren fields of the Arabs. Nazareth was much as Jesus must have found it in his youth. Ari parked in the center of town. He brushed off a group of Arab urchins, but one child persisted.
Guide?
No.
Souvenirs? I got wood from the cross, cloth from the robe.
Get lost.
Dirty pictures?
Ari tried to pass the boy, but he clung on and grabbed Ari by the pants leg.
Maybe you like my sister. She is a virgin.
Ari flipped the boy a coin. Guard the car with your life. Nazareth stank. The streets were littered with dung, and blind beggars made wretched noises, and barefoot, ragged, filthy children were underfoot. Flies were everywhere. Kitty held Ari's arm tightly as they wound through the bazaar
and to a place alleged to be Mary's kitchen and Joseph's carpenter shop. Kitty was baffled as they drove from Nazareth. It was a dreadful place.
At least the Arabs are friendly, Ari said. They are Christians.
They are Christians who need a bath. They stopped once more at Kfar Kana, at the church where Christ performed his first miracle of changing water to wine. It was set in a pretty and timeless Arab village. Kitty was trying to digest all that she had seen in the past few days. It was such a small land, but every inch held ghosts of blood or glory. At certain moments, the very sacredness of it was gripping. At other moments, exultation turned to revulsion. Some of the holy places struck her speechless with awe, and others left her with the cold suspicion of one watching a shell game in a carnival. The wailing Jews of Meir Shearim and the burning refinery, the aggressive Sabras of Tel Aviv and the farmers of the Yisrael. The old and the new jammed together. There were paradoxes and contradictions at every turn. It was very late afternoon when Ari turned into the gates of Yad El. He stopped before a flower-bedecked cottage.
"Ari, how lovely it is," Kitty said.
The cottage door opened, and Sarah Ben-Kanan ran from it.
"Ari, Ari!"
She was swept into his arms.
"Shalom, Emma."
"Ari, Ari, Ari."
"Now don't cry, Emma. Shh, don't cry, don't cry."
Kitty saw the massive Barak Ben-Kanan rush out and throw his arms about his son.
"Shalom, Abba, shalom."
The old giant clung to his son and slapped his back again and again, repeating,
"You look good, Ari. You look good."
Sarah studied her son's face.
"He is tired. Can't you see how tired he is, Barak?"
"I'm fine, Emma. I have company. I want you to meet Mrs. Catherine Fremont. She's going to work at Gandafna tomorrow."
"So you are Catherine Fremont," Barak said, taking her hand in his two giant paws. "Welcome to Yad El."
"Ari, you're such a fool," his mother said. "Why didn't you telephone and say you were bringing Mrs. Fremont? Come in, come in. You'll take a shower, you'll change your clothes, I'll make a little to eat, and you'll feel better. You're such a fool, Ari."
Sarah put her arm around Kitty's waist and led her toward the cottage.
"Barak, bring Mrs. Fremont's luggage."
Yordana Ben-Kanan stood before the newly arrived Exodus children in the outdoor theater. She was tall and straight, with a statuesque carriage and long, shapely legs. Yordana, with red hair hanging free below her shoulders, had a striking and classic beauty. She was 19 years of age and had been in the Palmach since leaving the university. The Palmach assigned Yordana to Gandafna to head the Gadna unit, which gave military training to all children in the village over 14 years. Gandafna was also one of the prime places for hiding arms and smuggling them to the Hula settlements. Yordana also worked on the mobile Voice of Israel secret radio when it transmitted in the Hula. Yordana lived at Gandafna, right in her office.
"I am Yordana Ben-Kanan," she said to the Exodus children. "I am your Gadna commander. In the next weeks you will learn spying, messenger work, arms cleaning and firing, stick fighting, and we will have several cross-country hikes. You are in Palestine now, and never again do you have to lower your head or know fear for being a Jew. We are going to work very hard, for Eretz Yisrael needs you. Tomorrow we will have our first hike. We will go over the hills north to Tel Hai. My father came to Palestine through Tel Hai nearly 60 years ago. It is the place where our great hero, Joseph Trumpeldor, died. Trumpeldor is buried there, and a great stone lion near the graveyard looks down upon the Hula, just as the statue of Daphne looks upon the Hula. On the lion are written the words, 'It is good to die for one's country.' I might add to that, it is good to have a country to die for."
As Jordana entered the administration building later, she was called to the telephone. She lifted the receiver.
Shalom, Jordana here.
Shalom. This is Emma. Ari is home.
Ari?
Jordana ran from her office to the stable. She mounted her father's white Arab stallion and spurred him through the gates of Gandafna. She galloped bareback down the road toward the village of Abu Yasha, with her scarlet hair waving in the wind behind her. She galloped full speed into the main street of the Arab village, sending a dozen people scurrying for safety. The men at the coffee house turned and sneered. What a disrespectful prostitute this red-headed bitch was to dare ride through their streets wearing shorts. It was fortunate for her that she was the daughter of Barak and the sister of Ari. Ari took Kitty's hand and led her through the door. Come along, he said. I want to show you some of the farm before it turns dark.
Did you have enough to eat, Mrs. Fremont?
I'm ready to burst.
And the room is comfortable?
I'm just fine, Mrs. Ben-Kanan.
Well, don't be too long. Dinner will be ready when Jordana gets down from Gandafna.
Sarah and Barak stared after them, then looked at each other.
She is a beautiful woman. But for our Ari?
Stop being a Yiddish mama. Don't go making a shidduch for Ari, Barak said.
What are you talking, Barak? Can't you see the way he looks at her? Don't you know your own son yet? He is so tired.
Ari and Kitty walked through Sarah's garden on the side of the house to the low rail fence. Ari put his foot up on the rail and looked out over the fields of the Moshav. The water sprinklers were whirling a cooling spray, and the orchard trembled lightly in the evening breeze. The air was scented with the fragrance of Sarah's winter roses. Kitty watched Ari as he looked out at his land. For the first time since she had known Ari Ben-Kanan, he seemed to be at peace. They are rare moments for him, Kitty thought, remembering that brief period of peace in Jerusalem.
Not much like your Indiana, I'm afraid, Ari said.
It will do.
Well, you didn't have to build Indiana out of a swamp.
Ari wanted to say much more to Kitty. He wanted to talk about how much he longed to be able to come home and work on his land. He wanted to beg her to understand what it was for his people to own land like this. Kitty was leaning over the fence, gazing at the beauty and proud achievement that Yad El represented. She looked radiant. Ari was filled with a desire to take her in his arms and hold her. But he did nothing and said nothing. They turned away together and walked along the fence until they came to the barn buildings, where the cackle of chickens and the honk of a goose met their ears. He opened the gate. The hinge was broken.
That needs fixing, he said. A lot of things need fixing. I'm away all the time, and Jordana is gone, too. My father is away at conferences so much. I'm afraid the Ben-Kanan farm has become a village liability. The whole Moshav has the responsibility. Someday we are all going to be home together. Then you'll really see something.
They stopped by a hog pen where a sow lay panting in the mud as a dozen gluttonous pigs fought to get at her teats.
Zebras, Ari said.
If I wasn't an old zebra expert, I'd swear I was looking at pigs, Kitty answered.
Shh, not so loud. There might be someone from the land fund eavesdropping. We aren't supposed to raise zebras on Jewish national land. Up at Gandafna, the children call them pelicans. At the kibbutz, they are more realistic. They are spoken of as comrades.
They walked beyond the barn, chicken house, and machinery shed to the edge of the fields.
You can see Gandafna from here.
Ari stood behind her and pointed to the hills near the Lebanese border.
Those white houses?
No, that's an Arab village called Abu Yasha. Now, look to the right of it and farther up where those trees are, on the plateau.
Oh, yes, I see it now. My, it's really up in the air. What is that building behind it on top of the hill?
Fort Esther,
a British border station. Come along. I have something else to show you. They walked through the fields as it began to turn dusk, and the sun played strange tricks of coloring on the hills. They came to a wooded area on the edge of the fields where a stream rushed past toward the Hula Lake. Your colored people in America sing very pretty spirituals about this stream.
Is this the Jordan?
Yes. Ari moved close to Kitty, and they looked solemnly at each other. Do you like it? Do you like my parents? Kitty nodded. She waited for Ari to take her in his arms. His hands touched her shoulders.
Ari! Ari! Ari!
A voice shouted from a distance. He released Kitty and spun around. A horse and rider were racing toward them, framed by the dying red sun. Soon they could make out the figure, the straight back, and the flaming hair.
Jordana!
She pulled the frothing horse to a halt, threw up both her arms and screamed for joy and leaped down on Ari so hard they both crashed to the ground. Jordana climbed on top of Ari and smothered his face with kisses.
Cut it out,
he protested.
Ari, I love you to pieces.
Jordana began to tickle him, and they rolled over, wrestling. Ari was forced to pin her down to hold her still. Kitty watched with amusement. Suddenly Jordana saw her, and her expression froze. Ari, remembering Kitty's presence, smiled sheepishly and helped Jordana to her feet. My overwrought young sister. I think she mistook me for David Ben-Ami.
Hello, Jordana, Kitty said. I feel as though I know you, from David.
She extended her hand.
You are Catherine Fremont. I have heard of you, too.
The handshake was cold, and Kitty was puzzled. Jordana turned quickly and picked up the reins of her horse and led him back toward the house, as Ari and Kitty followed.
Did you see David?
Jordana turned and asked Ari.
He is in Jerusalem for a few days. He told me to say he would phone you tonight, and he will be here by the end of the week, unless you want to go to Jerusalem.
I can't with those new children at Gandafna.
Ari winked at Kitty. Oh, he continued to Jordana. By the way, I saw Avidan in Tel Aviv. He did mention something or other about... Now let me see. Yes. About transferring David to the Galilee Brigade at Ein Or. Jordana turned. Her blue eyes widened, and for an instant she was unable to speak.
Ari, you mean it? You're not teasing me?
Ari shrugged. Silly girl.
Oh, I hate you. Why didn't you tell me?
I didn't know it was that important. Jordana was about to jump on Ari and wrestle with him again, but Kitty's presence obviously restrained her.
I am so happy, she said.
Another dinner was forced upon Kitty, who did her best by it when it became apparent that refusal would come close to creating an international incident. When dinner was done, Sarah brought out tables full of snacks for the company that would be arriving. That evening, almost everyone at Yad El came to the Ben Canaan home to welcome Ari and to satisfy curiosity about the American woman. There was, in discreet Hebrew, excited speculation. They were a rugged and friendly lot of people, and they went out of their way to make Kitty feel like visiting nobility. Ari hovered near her during the evening with the intent of protecting her from a torrent of questions, but marveled at the ease with which Kitty was able to handle the pressing group. As the evening wore on, Jordana became more obvious in the coldness she had shown Kitty earlier. She was hostile, and Kitty knew it. She could almost read Jordana's thoughts. What kind of a woman are you who wants my brother? It was exactly what Jordana Ben-Canaan was thinking as she watched Kitty perform perfectly, charming the curious farmers of Yad El. Kitty looked like all the soft, white, useless wives of English officers who spent their days at tea and gossip around the King David Hotel. It was very late when the last guest left, and Ari and Barak were alone and able to speak. They talked at length about the farm. It was running well despite their absences. The Moshav saw to it that little was neglected during the protracted leaves of Ari, Jordana, and Barak.
Barak looked around the room for a cognac bottle with something left in it amid the shambles of the welcome home gathering. He poured his son a glass and one for himself. Both of them settled down and stretched their long legs out and relaxed.
Well, what about your Mrs. Fremont? We are all bursting with curiosity.
Sorry to disappoint you. She is in Palestine in the interest of a girl who came over on the Exodus. I understand she is anxious to adopt the child later. We have become friends.
Nothing more?
Nothing.
I like her, Ari. I like her very much. But she is not our kind.
Did you see Avedan in Tel Aviv?
Yes. I will be staying in the Hula Palmach at Ein Or, most likely. He wants to do an assessment of the strength of each village.
That is good. You have been away so much it will do Emma good to be able to fuss over you for a while.
What about you, father?
Barak scratched his red beard and sipped his cognac.
Avedan has asked me to go to London for the conferences.
I imagined he would.
Of course, we must keep stalling and fighting to gain a political victory. The Yishuv can't take a military showdown, so I'll go to London and add my bit. I hate to say it, but I am finally coming to the conclusion that the British are going to sell us out completely.
Ari arose and began pacing the room. He was almost sorry that Avedan hadn't sent him away on another assignment. At least, when he was working the clock around to complete a mission, he did not have time to think of the realities ready to crush the Yishuv.
Son, you had better go to Abu Yashah and see Taha.
I was surprised he wasn't here tonight.
Is something wrong?
Just what is wrong with the whole country? We have lived in peace with the people of Abu Yashah for 20 years. Kamal was my friend for a half century. Now there is a coldness. We know them all by first names. We have visited their homes, and they have attended our schools. We have celebrated weddings together. Ari, they are our friends. Whatever is wrong must be righted.
I will see him tomorrow, after I take Mrs. Fremont to Gandafna.
Ari leaned against the bookcases filled with classics in Hebrew, English, French, German, and Russian. He ran his fingers over them a moment and hesitated, then spun around and faced Barak.
I saw Akiva in Jerusalem.
Barak stiffened as though he had been struck. In reflex, his lips parted for an instant, but he stopped the words that would have asked how his brother was.
We will not discuss him under my roof, Barak said softly. He has grown old. He cannot live too much longer. He begs for you to make peace with him in the name of your father.
I do not want to hear it,
Barak cried, with a quiver in his voice.
Isn't 15 years of silence long enough?
Barak stood up to his towering height and looked into the eyes of his son.
He turned Jew against Jew. Now his Maccabees are turning the people of Abu Yashah against us. God may forgive him, but I never will. Never. Please listen to me. Good night, Ari.
The next morning, Kitty said goodbye to the Ben Canaan family, and Ari drove her from Yad El to the mountain road leading to Gandafna. At Abu Yashah, Ari stopped for a moment to have someone inform Taha he would be back in an hour or so. As their car moved high into the hills, Kitty grew more and more eager to see Karen, but at the same time she was apprehensive about Gandafna. Was Yordana Ben Canaan playing the role of a jealous sister? Or was she the forerunner of a kind of people who would be hostile because of their differences? Harriet Saltzman had warned her she was a stranger with no business in Palestine. Everyone and everything seemed to point out this difference. Yordana unsettled her. Kitty had tried to be sociable to everyone, but perhaps underneath she was drawing lines and too thinly disguising the fact.
I am what I am, Kitty thought, and I come from a place where people are judged for what they are.
As they drove into isolation, she felt alone and glum.
I must leave right away,
Ari said.
Will we be seeing each other?
Kitty asked. From time to time. Do you want to see me, Kitty?
Yes.
I will try, then. They turned the last corner, and the plateau of Gandafna spread before them. Dr. Lieberman, the village orchestra, the staff and faculty, and the 50 children from the Exodus were all clustered around the bronze statue of Daphna on the center green. There was a warm and spontaneous welcome for Kitty Fremont, and in that moment, her fears vanished. Karen rushed up to her and hugged her, and handed her a bouquet of winter roses. Then Kitty was engulfed by her Exodus children. She looked over her shoulder long enough to see Ari disappear. When the welcoming ceremony was over, Dr. Lieberman and Karen walked with Kitty into a tree-studded lane holding the neat little 2- and 3-room cottages of the staff. They came to a halt halfway down the dirt road before a white stucco house, which was deluged in blooms. Karen ran up on the porch and opened the door and held her breath as Kitty walked in slowly. The combination living room and bedroom was simple but tasteful. The draperies and the spread over the couch bed were of the thick Negev linen weave, and the room was almost buried under fresh-cut flowers. A paper cutout was strung from one side to the other. "Shalom, Kitty," it read, and it was from her children of the Exodus. Karen ran to the window and pulled the draperies back and revealed a panoramic view of the valley floor 2,000 feet below. There was another small room, a study, and a Pullman kitchen and bath. Everything had been prepared beautifully. Kitty broke into a smile.
"Shoo, shoo, shoo,"
Dr. Lieberman said, whisking Karen out of the door.
"You will see Mrs. Fremont later. Shoo, shoo."
"Goodbye, Kitty." "Goodbye, dear."
"You like it?" Dr. Lieberman asked.
"I will be very comfortable here."
Dr. Lieberman sat on the edge of the couch.
"When your children from the Exodus heard you were coming to Gandafna, they worked day and night. They painted the cottage, they made the drapes, they brought in plants. All the plants in Gandafna are on your lawn. They made a big fuss. They love you very much."
Kitty was very touched.
"I don't know why they should."
"Children are instinctive about knowing who their friends are. You would like to see Gandafna now?"
"Yes, I'd love to."
Kitty stood a head taller than Dr. Lieberman. They strolled back toward the administration buildings. He walked with his hands alternately clasped behind him and patting his pockets, searching for matches to light his pipe.
"I came from Germany in 1933. I guess I knew quite early what was going to happen. My wife passed away shortly after we arrived. I taught humanities at the university until 1940, when Harriet Saltzman asked me to come up here and found a youth Aliyah village. Actually, I had been longing to do just that for many years. This entire plateau was given to us by the late Mukhtar of Abu Yesha, a most generous man. If only our relations could be a model for all Jews and Arabs.
Do you have a match?" "No, I'm sorry, not with me."
"Never mind, I smoke too much."
They came to the center green, where the view of the Hula Valley was the best.
"Our fields are down on the floor of the valley. The land was given to us by the Yad El Moshav."
They stopped before the statue.
"This is Daphna. She was a girl from Yad El who died in the Haganah. The sweetheart of Ari Ben Canaan. Our village is named for her."
Kitty felt a flash of, yes, jealousy. The power of Daphna was there even in sculpture. Kitty could see in the bronze that rugged earthiness of Yordana Ben Canaan and the other farm girls who were in the Ben Canaan home last night. Dr. Lieberman waved both hands.
"In all directions we are surrounded by history. Across the valley you see Mount Hermon, and near it is the site of ancient Dan. I could go on for an hour. It is filled with the past.
The little hunchback looked fondly around at his creation and took Kitty's arm and led her on.
We Jews have created a strange civilization in Palestine. In every other place in the world, the culture of its people has almost always come from the large cities. Here, it is just the reverse. The eternal longing of the Jewish people to own land is so great that this is where our new heritage comes from. Our music, our poetry, our art, our scholars, and our soldiers came from the kibbutz and the moshav. See these children's cottages?
Yes.
You will notice how all the windows face the fields of the valley, so their land will be the first thing they see in the morning and the last thing they see at night. Half of the schooling here is in agriculture. From this village, groups have gone out and started or joined in 4 new kibbutzim. We are self-sustaining in food. We own our own dairy and poultry and cattle. We even weave much of our own cloth. We make our own furniture, and we repair our farm machinery in our own shops. All this is done by the children, and they govern themselves, and very well, too.
They reached the far end of the green. Just before the administration building, the beautiful lawn was abruptly broken by a long trench that circled the entire area. Kitty looked around and sighted more trenches and a bomb shelter.
It is very ugly, Dr. Lieberman said, and there is too much worship of fighters among our children. I am afraid that condition will last until we win our independence and can base existence on something more human than arms.
They walked along the trench. Kitty became intrigued by an odd phenomenon. The trench works ran past a few scraggly trees. One of the trenches had been dug close to the root system of one of the trees, and the roots were bared. The trench